All of you on the gutter.
One, two, ignition
and lift off. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
All right, and welcome everybody to another episode of the Talking Space Podcast. This is Talking Space episode 704 for the week of Monday, April 27th, 2015. I'm Sawyer Rosenstein, and joining me tonight is Gene McCulka. Welcome, Gene.
Good evening, sir. How the heck are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Please welcome as well Kat Robison.
Hey, everyone.
And welcome as well Cassie Tamanini, a.k.a. Craftlass.
Great to be here again.
All right, so we all sound exhausted. That's because there's a lot of space news that we've had to truck through here, so let's just get right into it then. And we will start off with the most recent launch as of this recording date, and that is the Progress 59 spacecraft on its way to resupply the International Space Station. It lifted off successfully from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan at 3:09 a.m. Eastern Time and made it all the way into space. And then they had difficulty communicating with the spacecraft. And as of this recording, they are still encountering difficulties with trying to get in contact and maintain data connection with the spacecraft. As a result, there was a worry that the docking antennas had not deployed. At this point, we're still not 100% positive whether they have or have not. And then when they got communication back after a while, all of a sudden the spacecraft was spinning out of control. They opted instead of the original 6-hour express approach for the 2-day approach and now have put it indefinitely postponed until they can figure out what is going on. So, oops.
Yeah, one big oops. Welcome to spaceflight, folks, where you just really don't know what's going to happen or what fate is going to throw at you here. To reiterate what you were saying, Sawyer, indeed, the 59 Progress cargo vehicle, for those of you who don't know exactly what the Progress is all about, it's a sort of a two-stage configuration. It kind of looks like the Soyuz, if you're familiar with that. I believe the upper portion is for dry goods. This is where the orbiter module would be. The bottom half is for propellant and so on that would be delivered to the International Space Station. I believe the numbers on the capacities, and I could be wrong on this one, but I think the number on the capacities here are for the dry cargo area or the spherical area. I believe it's about 4,000 pounds. For the tank module, which would essentially be the equivalent of the Soyuz descent stage, that has about 4,300 pound capacity. So it's kind of critical that this get to the ISS. What had occurred was right after launch, the solar panels opened up, everything looked good, but they could not get a confirmation that all of the communication antennas had opened up. And I believe we're talking about the CORS docking system, K-U-R-S. For those of you who are not familiar with that, the CORS docking system has been in place, since the Mir days. And it is used by the Progress module as a navigation system to just sort of tell the spacecraft where it is in relationship to its target. In this case, it would have been the International Space Station. But right now, I think the whole idea is the spacecraft is kind of kerfuffled because of those antennas not being opened up, if that's indeed the case.
All of this really goes to show how important redundancy is when it comes to spaceflight.
Yeah, it's a good point because, again, the Russians have kind of dropped the ball here. This is, I believe, Sawyer, if you could check me on this one, this vehicle, Progress 59, is carrying something like 6 tons of supplies to the International Space Station.
Yep, that's about 6,000, a little over 6,000 pounds of equipment and supplies, almost 2,000 pounds of fuel and propellants. oxygen, water, and just other foods and clothing, and I believe a few spare pieces as well for the U.S. side.
Right.
Yeah, as well as some scientific experiment hardware.
I also think, too, that some of the – I was looking up of what some folks were saying out on the social media boards, and it appeared, too, that – and these are folks that kind of know what's going on as far as the cargo stuff that's on board this thing. Also, one of the astronauts that are going up in the next increment, I believe the Easter astronaut will be going up in the next increment, his stuff is on that thing. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see how they're going to deal with the redundancy if they can't get this thing under control. For folks that are really interested, there's a really cool YouTube video that was distributed not too long after the event happened here that shows exactly what the progress would be looking at if you were on board, and the whole, you know, turning and spinning and all this. So it's a rather intriguing video. We'll throw it onto the show notes just to show you guys, but it really shows what the gyrations are and what the spacecraft has been doing for the past few hours. The whole idea right now, too. Now, Sawyer, you before I go any further, you were saying too that we're not in any danger of this thing coming in, are we? We're not in any danger of this thing reentering at this point.
The last thing I saw just before we started recording today is the 28th, by the way, so that's Tuesday, is that it was in a stable, I believe it was about a 180 by 260 kilometer orbit, which is definitely stable, definitely safe, and it gives them extra time to work on it. Because originally, they didn't get data confirming whether or not it was in a orbit that was going to decay rapidly or whether it had done the burns to basically save itself.
So the game plan right now was for the folks at the Russian Mission Control Center in Korolev to take a look at this at about 8:50 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It is 9:21 Eastern Daylight Time p.m. as we record this. So we're going to just sort of keep an eye out and see if there's any updates, and if there are, we'll break in. But I'm wondering, too, you know, there's a lot of critical stuff going on here with a lot of critical consumables on the Russian side. I'm wondering, too, how this will impact the U.S. side. We're already kind of behind the eight ball because of the Orb 3 failure last October, and we're trying to sort of catch up with that. So I'm wondering what the overall impact to ISS operations is going to be as a result of this.
Well, I think right now they're good for about 6 or 8 months, I believe, if not more, with supplies. But the big thing is going to be the importance of all of the upcoming resupply missions now. If this doesn't dock to the station, that adds all the more importance to the next SpaceX resupply mission, which I believe is June. And with no more ATVs and with Cygnus currently on hold, this is kind of big.
Yeah, I believe we have a Japanese HTV somewhere in the mix coming up. And I think Cygnus is due to launch in November.
Believe right, HTV is August.
Okay, so we do have CRS-7 coming up this summer. We also have an HTV coming up this summer. And then we have Orbital getting back on track, this time using an Atlas V from the Kennedy Space Center to get back on the board again. So it sounds to me that we're going to be playing catch up, but we're not behind the eight ball is what I'm saying.
Like I said, this really demonstrates well the importance of redundancy and that they plan for incidents like this, you know, losing a supply, not being able to dock in the stocking of what is available in the space station.
That's a good point there, Kat. And again, this isn't the first time something like this has happened. Even if we do, you know, even if fate goes ahead and says too bad and we lose this bird, this has happened before where we had a progress module, I believe, crashed not too long after shuttle was decommissioned. We've been in this predicament before. And again, as you pointed out, Kat, we've got a whole conglomeration of other cargo means to get, you know, material up and down to the ISS. Right now, the only way, however, to get material up and down from the ISS is either a Soyuz or Dragon. I'm sure, you know, knock on wood, you know, we could get this bird wrangled. But I'm sure, too, if we can't, those cargoes could be kind of refitted and reset for to augment what was lost.
Exactly. So we'll keep an eye on that, and hopefully they will be getting their supplies shortly, hopefully even before the next episode. If not, you'll certainly find out. Okay, then. So we've had a few other launches within the last few days as well. There was a successful launch of an Ariane 5 on Sunday, and then another launch on Monday, the 27th. That was of a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. That launch occurred at 7.03 p.m. Eastern Time after a few weather delays, carrying the first ever satellite for Turkmenistan.
Yeah, thanks, Sawyer. This was, again, as you pointed out, this was Turkmenistan's first vehicle. The company called Thales Alenia, the same folks that used to bring the cargo section of the ATV, and of course, they were also responsible for the multipurpose logistics modules, and today are also responsible for the actual pressurized cargo container for Cygnus. Thales Alenia built this, I believe it's a communication satellite for Turkmenistan. Initially, if I recall precisely, I've seen this in several outlets, a Chinese Long March 3 was supposed to launch this thing, but somehow or other, SpaceX was able to go ahead and kind of say, we'll take care of it, and kind of grab the business away from the Chinese in this case. So, bravo. But again, all's well that ends well, and Turkmenistan is on the board, so we have a new player in space. Welcome aboard.
All right, then. So congratulations to Turkmenistan on their first satellite. And again, as I mentioned, there were two satellites that were launched on the Ariane 5, so congrats to them as well. Now we continue along here, and in case you did not know, this past week was the 25th anniversary of the deployment of the Hubble Space Telescope on STS-31. You may remember there were a few issues when Hubble was first deployed, including the fact that the mirror was not set up correctly, and as a result, Hubble kind of had blurry vision. That led to 5 repair missions to the Hubble Space Telescope, including that first one, which put on a corrective lens and therefore allowed Hubble to look out into the universe and send back some absolutely amazing images and some great science. And it has been one heck of a 25-year lifespan. And now they're saying that Hubble should last until the James Webb Space Telescope, Hubble's replacement, launches.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That's what, Cassie, that's what you and I were hearing at the Northeast Astronomy Forum about 2 weeks ago, where a lot of the folks over there were saying that Hubble should be up there while Webb was being commissioned. And, you know, the two for a little bit will be kind of partnering together and can at least partner together in some way and try to see what else they could do before we lose Hubble. Because, again, we've lost the shuttle and there's really no other way to properly service Hubble without the orbiters. Plus, Hubble's getting a little bit long in the tooth. It's been up there for about 25 years. Right now, if you were able to bring it back, it would be a metallurgist's dream. I know a lot of people who are engineers would love to analyze, get underneath there, and discover how Hubble's any metal on board the spacecraft dealt with the long duration of dealing with the vacuum and the rigors that spaceflight puts on there. But again, Hubble's getting a little long in the tooth. She's done some wonderful work, but I think it's kind of time to move on to the James Webb Telescope and the other telescopes that are out there. And let's not forget, there are two, well, shall I say, toys, for lack of a better phrase, that NASA inherited from the National Reconnaissance Office. And these are rumored to be basically keyhole satellites, and Hubble is rumored to be based on a keyhole satellite. So essentially, somewhere NASA has two incomplete Hubble Space Telescopes. And I understand, too, that the mirrors internally on these things could be pointed in any which direction, something that Hubble right now lacks, that does not have this feature. And Sawyer, to pick apart what you were, well, not to exactly pick apart, but to just kind of put some history in there, what had happened with the mirror? The mirror was ground to, like, you know, within a hair's breadth the wrong way. This was by a company called PerkinElmer. The sad part about it is the backup mirror that was grounded by Kodak Company, and I believe maybe on display, I want to say, at the National Air and Space Museum somewhere. That mirror is perfect. That's the one we really should have used and not the one that's in the telescope now. At any rate, we went ahead. We had a really, really daring repair mission. We went forward, and wow, you know, it has been just an incredible ride of discovery. And Hubble's basically become not only a scientific icon, but I want to say a cultural icon too.
The Hubble Deep Field image literally changed the way we view space. It is the iconic image of the mission. And for that, Hubble will be remembered long after many other missions because of the way it changed what we perceive the sky as containing.
It will be essentially the modern version of, you know, the old star maps that the great astronomers of the past made, only it's that much better. It changed not just, it changed our perception of the universe, it changed our perception of time. And it's one of the few things, I mean, Hubble pictures in general are some of the best tools to communicate with the lay public, the people who don't care at all about space in their everyday lives. You can stop them dead in their tracks with a Hubble image and ask them if they support NASA in that moment, and they're thinking about Hubble, and they, for that moment, they just absolutely love everything NASA does just because of that image. That's how spectacular these things are. They're always, always going to have a place in astronomical history. Just like Copernicus's drawing of, you know, how the Earth, you know, moves. There are some things that are irreplaceable, and a lot of what the Hubble sent back certainly is, but the Deep Field is truly iconic.
Cassie, I couldn't have said that any better. I mean that.
Thank you.
I just again, if you take somebody that really doesn't care about NASA and you show them, for instance, a lot of the iconic Hubble images, even their jaws just drop. So it's a great way of introducing people not only to NASA, but also to astronomy and to just looking up at the night sky and just knowing what's out there.
We should also mention that the iconic deep field isn't the only deep field image taken by Hubble. There are several other deep field images, including the ultra deep field taken in 2004 that shows us the earliest pictures we have of our universe forming. We basically know about how our universe came to be thanks to Hubble. Hubble is a way, as Carl Sagan would say, for us to know ourselves. We are the universe looking up at ourselves, and Hubble helped us to do that.
Agreed. And one of the really fascinating experiments was suggested by Ed Wheeler, who was then the director of planetary science. And his idea was to aim the telescope at an area that looked just blank, like really just looked like there was nothing there at all. And there was a lot of grumbling when Ed Wheeler mentioned that. And said, well, what the heck do you expect to find? Well, they did that. And what did they find? Millions and millions of galaxies that they didn't even know about. So it was just such a breathtaking image. And it's just one of those, that's essentially what this whole mission was really, really all about, finding what wasn't there. I mean, this was really, really our first look at the universe as a whole. And Hubble is destined to, unfortunately, enter, you know, the Earth's atmosphere. But when it does, wow, what a legacy it's going to leave behind.
Well, we'll see if it'll enter soon, because I know some people have been talking about using a SpaceX, modifying a SpaceX Dragon capsule and going up and resurfacing Hubble again?
Yeah, this is actually a thought experiment that was put together by Donald F. Robertson, who wrote a op-ed in Space News this week. He's a freelance journalist based out in San Francisco. According to the write-up, he's a shareholder of Orbital ATK, and I guess he's just doing that for disclosure purposes. But he's got a what I think is sort of a, I don't know, a half-baked plan to use a SpaceX Dragon carrying some equipment to go ahead and service the Hubble again. My question is, who's going to pay for it? Number two is, I don't want to say throwing good money after bad, but Hubble is kind of long in the tooth. I believe it has six gyroscopes on board. I know two of which are not functioning anymore. They need at least three to keep the spacecraft going. Although I'm hearing from other reports that you could probably keep the thing going with two. But I'm sort of ambiguous with this whole plan that he's hatched and this whole suggestion.
Well, here's the thing, Gene. Hubble was amazing, is amazing, but it's no longer something NASA should be spending taxpayer money on. Just like we needed to retire the space shuttle so that we could go on to the next step and get NASA out of the low Earth business so that we can move beyond, it's time for Hubble to no longer be a budget priority or on the budget for NASA. It's time for the next big thing. You know, if some private corporation or some billionaire comes up with the money and says, hey, I want to pay SpaceX to go rescue this, I mean, that's great. If someone wants to rescue it privately, I'm all for that. But when it comes to what we're going to spend NASA's limited resources on, NASA's directive is to push forward the scientific understanding of humanity, in essence. You know, it's about being the leader in space exploration and space research and science research. And NASA can't be the leader if it's spending valuable budget dollars on fixing old, out-of-date equipment.
Well, to that point, there was another op-ed in the same periodical, Space News, by Dr. John Morris, who, Cassie, you know from the presentation at NEEF that he did on Hubble. He's a card-carrying Hubble hugger. He said it during the presentation, but he kind of blew this whole idea apart, basically pointing out that the 2001 decadal survey that's entitled Astronomy, Astrophysics in the New Millennium stated that they endorse the plan to go ahead and repair Hubble for this final time. But after that, it was pretty much there are other things in the pipeline that we're really, really gearing up for. And as you pointed out, Kat, that's what they're trying to do. That's what they're saying. And again, and this is another argument that you present, Kat, that Dr. John Morris kind of reiterates here too. He says, quote, in other words, in tight fiscal environments that will be clearly persistent for at least the rest of the decade, the scientific community is prepared to press on to new scientific priorities and new observatories that will expand our capabilities beyond Hubble's, close quote. So, again, that kind of adds fuel to your fire.
I mean, it's an interesting idea, and I know everyone's crazy for Hubble, and there are a lot of, as you said, Hubble huggers out there, hashtag Hubble hugger, but it's an old telescope. It's 25 years old and counting. It's showing its age, and unlike the space shuttle, which we could have kept going because we could have kept working on it and repairing it, there's no more ways, basically, to repair Hubble at this point. It's out there, it's on its own, and it's going to decay how it decays. As much as I would love to see it continue, and we will see it continue at least for the next few years, hopefully, as long as all those gyros maintain, we're going to still get some great science out of it. And hopefully James Webb will speed its butt up and we can get some we can get that up into orbit soon as well. But that's a whole another budgetary government red tape deal. But as soon as that goes up, that's going to be some amazing science as well. And we're going to look back and go, okay, Hubble was nice, but James Webb is amazing, kind of like going from the first Mercury Redstone to the Saturn V.
Yeah, and I don't even want to go into the political morass that the James Webb Telescope had to go through and its budget problems and so on, but it looks like those are now in the past, and the James Webb Telescope looks like it's on track for a launch in 2018, and I'm so looking forward to seeing what that instrument can do. And again, as we said before, the two telescopes, if they're still part and can still partner and can still do some significant science before we lose Hubble altogether. And again, Hubble has done a remarkable job. It's had its day and it's made its mark in history, and it will never be forgotten.
This is another one of those things where it's easy to get sentimental. And, you know, like Sawyer, you brought up the shuttle, which, yeah, they could have kept going a bit longer, but they just get more expensive to maintain. And obviously, it was a budget priority issue. And it's similar with Hubble. People are very sentimental about it. Hubble is probably, actually, I've now seen three different Hubble movies in the past 2 weeks, and I seem to recall one of them basically said Hubble is America's favorite mission of NASA. And that's including Apollo in that statement. You know, Apollo wasn't actually overwhelmingly popularly supported. Hubble is. And that's huge. It's actually, in some ways, you know, from a political standpoint, it's the most important project NASA has ever embarked upon as far as getting public support. The drive to repair Hubble when they weren't going to repair Hubble was driven partly by politicians, but partly by the public standing up to the government. It's an incredible story of the public standing up and saying, this is what we want, and it actually happening and turning out spectacularly as you could have hoped for. So there's a symbolic side and a sentimental side to Hubble that's very different from other missions. The problem is that science can't run on sentimentality. We can't choose science budgets based on what we like or what's popular.
Or there's no crying in baseball, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes you have to let go of that sentimentality and just be really happy we had Hubble and that it advanced us so much. And it's got a little more time left anyway. But yeah, at some point you're throwing away money. But like Kat said, it'd be great if some billionaire or consortium of billionaires wants to get together and pay SpaceX, or, you know, if Elon Musk just wants to do it.
I was about to say that. Or Elon Musk.
That's sort of what Robertson is saying, that SpaceX could go ahead and take it over and basically lease time on it and keep it going. I don't think that's even in their business model. I mean, they are in the commercial satellite launching business.
Period. You know, it does bring up an interesting question for the future. When there will be a point when spaceflight becomes ordinary, and I know that some people think of it as that now, but it's really not. But what happens when it comes to a point when we start to salvage space junk? Might not happen with Hubble, but maybe, you know, the next generation, when James Webb Space Telescope is ready to go and NASA no longer wants to fund it, will they salvage satellites like ships get salvaged at sea now? It's an interesting question and an interesting thought that, you know, in 50, 100 years from now will be a question that we'll be asking ourselves.
It's funny you should say that. That opens up the door. If anybody's interested, they could look up a lady by the name of Alice Gorman, who goes by the Twitter handle of Dr. Space Junk, and that's exactly what she's looking at right now. Sort of one person's junk is another person's historical artifact, and she's saying that eventually we're going to be looking at spaceflight and space artifacts in the same way. So,
and you know, when we were at IAC in the fall, we went to some presentations and poster presentations that were the business argument for collecting space junk, as well as the technical ways of doing it. And there are so many ideas out there on how to do it. And there are businesses that are looking very, very hard at how much money they can make off of it. Eventually, it will be profitable. And that eventually is probably not that far off here.
Yeah, we've really explored. Sawyer, you know this more than anybody. We've kind of explored that area of expertise for a little while, and I'm sure the problem is it's much more than a tech. If you're talking about trying to get rid of orbital debris, yeah, the technical problems are a snap. That's not the problem. The problem right now are legal aspects, and that's where you get into all sorts of stuff. So,
but that's the thing is, but you have to remember, all of these problems are being worked on concurrently. So the hope is that in, as Kat said, 20, 50, 100 years, this is all going to be just part of everyday life. It's just going to be part of our laws, the way we have laws about flying an airplane or driving a car. There's going to be a whole body of law. Space law is already such an intense and complicated topic, and it's only going to get crazier from here. And that includes the space junk question. But these are things that are going to have to be dealt with on all of these levels. So that's going to be worked on concurrently. And hopefully by the time, because we're already having problems with space junk and there can be issues with it, this is something that's going to have to be solved. It's not even a question of if, it's a question of when.
I will defer that to another program, because that's a whole different can of worms.
That can be quite a few programs.
Yeah, the UN's involved. There's a whole. I have a couple of acquaintances that I know that are working in that area, and it's a whole can of worms that I don't think we should go into on this program.
Right, but the point is that everything new is a can of worms, and everything gets figured out in the long run.
I think right now it's kind of that's kind of a simplistic way of looking at it, but
it's going to become a need, and that's going to change things.
Well, it already is. It's a need now.
Yes, but
there's no way to deal with it. So while it's a need now, we just can't send up spaceships. We can't send up capsules. We can't send up Orion, Dragon, just willy nilly. We just don't have that. It's an issue that we can talk about now, but until the avenue to actually deal with it exists, nothing's going to happen. And I think that that's the point that Cassie is making, not to look at it simplistically, but that is while we can talk about solutions now, until we actually have the ability to deal with these problems, because spaceflight is an ordinary, affordable aspect of our daily life, it's nothing that's going to be solved.
Lots of interesting thoughts here. I don't even know where to go with this.
I know. Well, you know, Kat and I, we can always go over to the politics side of things and the policy.
Speaking of which, sorry.
I was going to say, how about we go there then? Because we've got a whole bunch of government roundup stuff to deal with here. We'll start off first with the lighter of the topics. And that is, for the first time since 2013, NASA once again has a deputy administrator. In 2013, Lori Garver stepped down from the position. And finally today, the Senate confirmed her follow-up. And that is Dava Newman. She is the new deputy administrator of NASA. Her prior experience was working with advanced spacesuit concepts at MIT, and now she'll be helping out Charlie Bolden in helping to run NASA.
I think this is fantastic that she's finally been confirmed. She will be a really interesting addition to NASA. Those of you listening out there may be aware she works on new spacesuit concepts. She was one of the creators of the streamlined biosuit, helping to improve spacesuits for astronaut mobility while maintaining their protective nature. And I'm really glad to see, you know, although she's been, was nominated and it's kind of been a few months of this process, I'm just really glad to see a continued commitment to diversity at the top of NASA. It's really good to see someone like Dava Newman, who is incredibly accomplished, has been a professor at MIT for some time, and really understands how different technologies integrate and are important to NASA. So for me personally, it's going to be very interesting to see how she kind of brings her outside experience into dealing with administrating a government agency.
Be a very different environment than academia, that's for sure. But what's really interesting about her is she does have masters in not just aeronautics and astronautics, but in technology and policy. So it's a pretty incredible background for this particular job, I think.
She comes in here pretty well prepared, I'll say that much, but she's not a pure, what can I say, policy wonk, if you will, where Lori Garver was.
Yeah, and she's a technologist.
Right, and I think that's going to be an added plus in this current environment, especially when we're trying to develop new technologies and new ways of doing things and for a possible Mars shot. So plus the...
And her experience is perfect for NASA right now. Because NASA is so, the private-public partnerships are so important to NASA right now. And I think she's someone who really understands a private and public partnership. You have to be to have been at MIT for as long as she is. There is a lot of private and public partnership that goes on there. And with where NASA is at right now, that experience is invaluable. To have someone coming from the private sector into the public sector with an understanding of both, I think she's going to be a really good addition to the agency.
I mean, I was just looking at her MIT bio, some of the courses she's taught, leadership development, introduction to space, aerospace engineering and design. She taught a seminar, Beyond the Space Station, Future Human Planetary Exploration, Aerospace, Biomedical, and Life Support Engineering and Bioengineering. And she was also part of a bioengineering seminar as well. So she comes pretty well equipped to deal with the challenges that NASA faces. So it will be very, very interesting to see how she deals with the agency as opposed to the way Lori Garver did.
Obviously, she's eminently qualified. In fact, I can't think of that many people who have backgrounds that involve bringing together so many disparate skills. So that's perfect. But it really just comes down to if whether or not she's going to work well within that NASA federal environment.
She will.
Only one way to find out. And that will be once everything gets put into place and she begins her job, which we don't know exactly when that is yet, but hopefully sooner than later.
Right. We just need for Obama to sign off on her, and then they'll hopefully put up a start date. But this is really exciting. I think it's really an interesting direction to go. And I've seen that bio suit in person. It's pretty cool. So it's definitely, definitely very different from anything that's been made before. So it's pretty exciting to see someone like her. And as Kat said, to see the commitment to diversity at the top. It's very, very exciting to see a real commitment to that.
Exactly. So now we move from the Senate over to the House, and that is the House Science Committee, as we get time for everyone's favorite part of NASA, balancing the budget.
Oh, boy. Yeah, Sawyer, this was the first in a very long process. This is essentially the markup that came through from the House subcommittee on science. And this is a two-year markup for the NASA authorization bill that is going to be looked at on this, I believe it's this week, April 30th. One of the things that got people's shorts in a knot is essentially there's a small cut in the earth sciences spending by, well, not exactly small, by about nearly $500 million from the administration's request. But that's been the real big loser. That $500 million kind of went to other areas, and the big winner looks like it's going to be the exploration systems, with commercial spaceflight not too far behind. But I kind of wish I'm looking at the numbers here. This is a sheet that Space News put together. a lot of people are disappointed. A lot of people are kind of on the fence. This is just the first in the process, though. This is going to get debated long and hard until it really, really goes up for a vote. And by the way, this is just the House doing it. We'll have to see what the Senate version looks like. And then it's time to kind of meet together and put it all together. The overall request was for $18,529,000,000. The House constrained was $18,010,000,000, I believe.
I think we should also just interject for anyone listening who may not be aware of the differences. When you hear us say the first budget, you said, Gene, was the aspirational budget, right, which assumes that the Budget Control Act, or you may be more familiar with sequestration, is lifted. So that's the aspirational numbers. The first set of numbers that Gene mentioned assumes that the Budget Control Act measures will expire. And then the second set assumes that they won't be lifted. And so therefore, that is a constrained budget. But just for anyone listening that might not be familiar with the policy lingo there's some definitions for you.
Yep. Thank you. You kind of beat me to the punch. I was getting there. So thanks a lot. Again, the numbers aren't all that far off from what we're looking at. Again, I will put this in the show notes and let you all take a look at this. But again, there are winners here. There's some losers here. But overall, I think we're kind of barking up the right tree here. However, Barbara McCluskey, who is not going to run for re-election, she is currently a senator from Maryland, has kind of looked at all of this going on in the House and said, oh, gosh darn it, this, in her words, looks a little, quote, too skimpy. And she was talking at a Maryland Space Business Roundtable in the D.C. area and said she would like to add a, quote, as yet undetermined money to the NASA budget request of 2016. She's basically looking at essentially maybe upping it to like maybe $19 billion, but I'm not holding my breath on this one. I've seen other politicians kind of try to go into that direction and hit a brick wall. However, we're talking about the same lady who essentially spearheaded a final Hubble repair mission. And without her, and I think also without the wisdom of Mike Griffin, the STS-125 mission probably would not have occurred as we know it. And so she has been able to muster great resources and try to get things moving again. It might be what she's looking for. She might be looking for a final legacy. And she has been one of the biggest champions for spaceflight in general. It's going to be sad to see one of our lions kind of leave the Senate. But I'm wondering how spaceflight's going to fare under the next senator from Maryland without Barbara McCluskey.
I do have to say that for all we tend to worry about NASA's budget because of the political climate, NASA is good for business. That's why you often do see bipartisan support for NASA. NASA does great for small business, which is something that all politicians like to be able to say they support. So we always see budgets come out. We always worry. We always talk about the specific line items and who's getting what money. But I think the one thing that we need to always keep in mind is that most politicians do support some NASA spending, because a lot of politicians are seeing investment in their localities because of NASA's commitment to investment in small business, especially through the public and private partnerships that NASA has been going towards over the last few years. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we talk about NASA's budget as a whole, is that politicians tend to like NASA and NASA's money, because NASA, as we've talked about before in this show, for every dollar the government puts into NASA, we're actually seeing a return on investment of $7 to $8. So politicians are able to see that NASA does create an economy that their districts can take part in. And so I just like to throw that out as a caution anytime we talk about NASA's budget, that yes, we always like a little bit more, and it would be great if we can get this budget up as a legacy for Senator McCluskey, but NASA is a positive for most politicians.
Yeah, even ones who don't like to spend money on anything can see a business case for NASA. And it also goes beyond just companies that are contracted by NASA to do space stuff. You know, we have added this spinoff segment to our show, right? And so you have even things like that where NASA even directly gives money to small businesses and works with small businesses to develop products. Its tentacles into our economy are huge. So it never really hurts a politician to support NASA.
So just to be devil's advocate here for a moment, I am senator from, oh, I don't know, I will say Wyoming. I don't have a NASA center in my state. I don't have really a lot going on in my state as relative to spaceflight. I will just throw it out there. Why should I get excited and why should I go ahead and put in another billion into the budget when my state needs other things?
Actually, Wyoming, like every other state, has a NASA space grant consortium and gets money from NASA for education. And they have space-related programs at their universities. So even in a place like Wyoming, there is a business case to be made for funding NASA, because even they are seeing directly invested NASA dollars in their state.
There you go. Every state gets something from NASA, and every person gets something back from NASA. And I think that's actually the perfect lead into our final segment, which is our new favorite segment on the show, and that is the spinoff of the week. And this time, it involves comfortable driving, I believe.
Yes, it does, Sawyer. We're going to talk today about the Nissan Zero Gravity seats, which I'd like to make a note, because this is a show by and for space geeks. I remember when the ads came out for the Nissan Altima that introduced the zero gravity seats, and I remember snickering a little bit. What do they mean like by that? I figured they meant they wanted you to feel like you were in zero gravity or something. It just sounded way too much like a catchphrase. Well, I looked into it, and it turns out they're pretty cool. Back in the early days of NASA for Gemini and Apollo, they designed everything for function. They didn't think about the comfort of the astronauts much at all. Then during Skylab, they took photographs of 12 astronauts aboard to study how the body naturally positions itself when it's at rest in microgravity. They examined the similarities between all of these photographs and used them to create what they called the neutral body position, or NBP, standard. This standard became a major component in creating the manned systems integration standards, which were intended to make all future human spaceflight more productive as well as healthy for astronauts. These standards apply to everything, and even though the exact standards have changed, they have updated over the years. The neutral body position work that they did aboard Skylab has informed design of everything, including even the cupola on the International Space Station and all the workstations. They incorporate this into all designs. Like with all NASA research, the research is out there in the public. So in 2005, Nissan's U.S. arm decided to look into that research, thinking that it could build a better car seat. The idea was that if you could find the closest thing to neutral body position, even though we're dealing with gravity, and make a seat that fully supports the spine, you could reduce fatigue and therefore have not just more comfortable, but safer drivers, especially on long journeys when you tend to zone out and get tired, as Kat knows, since she's been driving a lot lately. And so, anyway,
incidentally, I drive a Nissan, but mine does not have zero G seats, and so now I'm a little jealous.
Well, Akinari Hirao, who's the manager of the Vehicle Component Engineering Development Division at Nissan, he was saying the approach has always been for comfort in the sense of like people just, you know, the positions that we think of as being the most comfortable. But when you look at the neutral body position, it's a little like rocked back, and the position you hold your arms in, they design absolutely everything to support that position. And instead of just having adjustable lumbar support, like almost all other cars that have any adjustment in the back, this actually supports literally every bit of your spine. It's an articulated seat, so it's two pieces, and so it just folds right with your body. So they started with this NVP research, and then they worked with Yamazaki Laboratory in Japan at Keio University, and they designed simulators and experimental seats to test this, and they used musculoskeletal models to test the pressure points, and they found that this one certain design was working the best. And then they built some prototype seats, and they started testing on drivers. And when tested on long-distance highway drives, they found it reduced fatigue by 50% compared to conventional car seats. So in 2013, they released the seats on the Nissan Altima, and that's when we started seeing those ad campaigns that made some of us snicker. And, well, it turns out they not only gave it to the driver, but all seats in the car have this zero gravity based design, even the back seat, which obviously the back seats can't be adjusted the way front seats can, but they do foster sitting in MBP, and the passenger seat in the front is adjustable four ways, and the driver's seat is adjustable six ways. So it can be very customized to you, which is interesting for a mid-range car like the Altima. Usually this is something you would see in high-end cars like Mercedes or Nissan's own Infiniti line. But they introduced it first on the Altima, and now they've begun phasing them in across new models. This year, they just announced, actually last week, 1 week ago today, as we record, that it will be on the Murano, and it's also going to be on the Maxima and Rogue in 2016.
And if Nissan wants to go ahead and sponsor us, please call. We're right here.
Definitely, Nissan. Would you like to retrofit my Sentra with some zero seats? I will gladly take you up on that.
I have to say, I don't own a car, but if I was in the market for one right now, Nissan would very, very likely get my money just because of these seats. They really impressed me. I went from snickering to thinking, I just want to sit in these so badly. But what I love even more than the idea for the seats, which is great, I mean, it makes so much sense when you think about it, but the manager, Harao, says he is thankful for all of NASA's work on MBP. And he had this wonderful quote I found. In my personal opinion, it is very important that the valuable research results from government projects are open to the public. So I just want to applaud him for saying that, because this is exactly why NASA gives us such a large return on investment.
And there you go. There is your spinoff for this week. Who says NASA doesn't do anything for you? And with that, that also brings this episode to its conclusion. I'd like to thank everybody who joined us here tonight. Thank you for joining us, Gene McCulka.
Thanks, Sawyer. And hey, guys, don't forget to vote on what you think that white spot is on Ceres. Go to www.jpl.nasa.gov/dawn/world_Ceres and cast your vote now.
Yes, indeed. Feel free to cast your vote on that. Thank you as well for joining us, Kat Robison.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you as well for joining us, Craftless, a.k.a. Cassie Tamanini, a.k.a. Fit Beetle.
Always a great time. I guess I need to get rid of that Fifth Beetle title at some point, huh, now that I'm on every week.
I guess so.
For those who haven't been listening for a long time, I used to be a somewhat regular guest.
Yeah, now you're a little more than semi.
Now before we go, it's great to be part of the team.
Glad to have you. Now, before we sign off, just a quick update, since we are getting these in real time as we record, the latest pass of the Soyuz over the ground tracking stations where they could possibly give it a try to recontrol it came back no dice, with no major changes, no major control, no major updates. So it's not looking good for progress.
The
This is Gene McCulka just breaking in with an update on the 59 progress story. Now, according to NASA Television's Space Station Daily Update, which aired at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time today, Wednesday, April 29th, 2015, the ISS crew has been informed not to expect the Roscosmos 59 Progress cargo vessel to pay a call on the orbiting facility. Roscosmos has given up on trying to contact the unpiloted cargo ship and considers its 3 tons of material that was destined for the orbiting laboratory a total loss. The spacecraft is still tumbling at this time and eventually will fall out of orbit where it will be destroyed by the Earth's atmosphere. And contrary to some reports I've seen out there already, there is no danger from any debris from Progress hitting any populated areas. Well, when asked about the loss of 59 Progress by the AP's Marcia Dunn today, astronaut Scott Kelly, participating on the one-year increment on board the International Space Station, had the following to say about this development.
Well, we were both told recently by both the U.S. and Russian flight control centers that Roscosmos announced that the Progress will not be docking and will re-enter the Earth's atmosphere here some days in the future to be determined, but this progress is not coming to the space station. I'm not familiar with everything that was on the vehicle. I know the stuff that was on the manifested for the U.S. operational segment, which was a lot of clothing for Chell Lindgren and Kimia Yui, also some EVA hardware, but you know, the important thing is hardware can be replaced, and we'll replace all that hardware, and we'll continue to operate the space station. Well, we have a lot of redundancy on board the space station. The program plans for these kind of things to happen. They're very unfortunate when they do, but we do have supplies on board, and one of the great things about this international partnership is that we do have other vehicles that can resupply the space station. You know, when we had the Columbia accident, we were fortunate to have the Soyuz to be able to keep the space station manned, and we have other vehicles now, SpaceX, HTV, and hopefully Orbital soon that can continue to resupply us. So we should be okay. Long-term impact, both programs are looking at that right now. But I think we're going to be in good shape.
Scott Kelly's words were carried live via NASA television this morning. We'll have more on this story next week on Talking Space Episode 705, returning you now to Talking Space 704 as it was recorded on Tuesday, April 28th, 2015.
But we'll obviously be keeping an eye on that and keeping you posted on the updates. On next episode, we hope you'll join us for that. Until then, as always, have a great day, night, evening, or whatever it may be, where you are.